Hey guys, welcome to the Money Podcast. Time for a confession. I'm an efficiency freak. For as long as I can remember, it's been like a game for me to spend as little time as possible on chores by doing things like minimizing the time it takes to unload the dishwasher. For example, if you put the forks, the knives, and the spoons all in separate clusters in the silverware tray, you can grab a handful of them all at once. How about this? When I empty the trash, I keep extra trash bags at the bottom of the trash can so I don't have to go to the pantry and get a new trash bag. And when I vacuum the house, well, I got a Roomba for Christmas. But even if you don't suffer from a similar efficiency compulsion, you should still try to be as efficient as possible when it comes to managing your family's finances for at least two reasons. First, less time managing money means more time for fun stuff. And second, making things too complex or time-consuming often means leaving them undone, underdone, or badly done. In short, if you'd rather spend time laying on the beach and fooling with your finances, I'm here for you. There are tons of shortcuts you can use that are going to allow you to get 90% of the returns from your investments with only 10% of the time and 5% of the effort and knowledge. And that's what this week's Money Podcast is all about. We're going to explore how to manage your investment life with a minimum number of investments and in just a few minutes a year. As usual, my co-host will be financial journalist Miranda Marquette. Hi, Miranda.
Heyo.
Listening in and sometimes contributing is our producer and our novice investor, Aaron Freeman. Hey, Aaron.
Hello.
Okay, guys, before you go on, a disclaimer. Everyone you hear on this podcast is super brilliant, but don't ever take our advice on investing ideas, even if you hear something specific that we may personally own, because we don't know you, and what we own may not be good for you. So you always do your own research, and you always take your own advice, okay? So let's get back to our topic at hand. So what we're going to talk about today is how to make our investing life super, super simple. Is it possible, Miranda?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I like to think that I'm pretty, I do stuff pretty simply as it is. So, yeah.
How much time do you think you spend on your investments every year? Is that a fair question? Because you do this for a living.
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, like, as far as like fiddling with things, checking stuff out, all that stuff, I maybe spend like an hour a month. And I don't change much, especially with the bulk of my portfolio. Now, occasionally I'll try little experiments. This year has been a little bit out of the ordinary because I did spend a little bit more time in the first like 3 or 4 months of the year, deciding when to sell some things, doing my little Dogecoin experiment, and just, you know, kind of looking into, you know, I did buy some shares of a SPAC, and I did do a little bit of research and some experimentation. So spend a little bit more time. So, but you know, honestly, if I actually hit 20 hours this year of spending time on my, like in the whole year on investments, I'll be really surprised because I just really don't spend that much time.
Aaron, same question. How much time do you think you spend on your investments? And that includes, Aaron's a property investor. So how much time do you spend on your investments, Aaron?
Well, I'll break it apart. So on the stock end, because I'm a novice, because I'm new to this, and since we've been doing the podcast, I felt like I've been doing a lot of catch up because you guys are way ahead of the curve for me. And so I've noticed I'm spending way too much time on it. And I even had a chat with my wife and go, I need to pull back. It's ridiculous. It's time consuming because I'm trying to learn everything. So I have a little bit of a voice even on the show, but even so that I can understand what I'm doing. And I like this show because I'd like it to be a lot easier because I don't want to spend this much time on it. As far as houses go, that takes a lot of time.
Well, I mean, obviously doing maintenance and stuff, but yeah. Really thinking about your core investing portfolio, you don't spend a lot of time, but you're spending more time because you're learning new stuff now.
Right, right.
But now me, it's ridiculous. As a matter of fact, no lie, this morning I was up at 2:45. I get up every morning about that because I'm a 65-year-old guy with a shrinking prostate. Okay, say no more. So I watch Fast Money and Mad Money, Jim Cramer. This morning at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I do that pretty much every day. So I spend a couple hours on watching television shows all day long. I'm doing research. I mean, I spend hours, you know, researching this podcast. So in my own stuff, I own 30 different companies. So I spend a lot of time on this. However, I hasten to add, I love doing this. This is a big hobby for me.
But you're doing it for journalism though, for the most part.
I am doing it for journalism.
Because when we're doing our market update, you're telling us I'm not really investing all that much. I'm not doing any trading.
That's true.
But
I'm always looking for something. Yeah, you're right, Aaron. I guess it's kind of hard for all three of us really, because this is what I do for a living. So it's kind of hard to say if I was retired and didn't have any of this to do, I probably would still spend a lot more than a few minutes a year at it. But because I like it though. You know, I mean, it's something, and I've done it for 40 years. I mean, I've been doing this since I was 25.
And I will say this. I'm sorry to cut you off, Marita, but I just want to get this in there. What I've noticed in just this little bit of time that I started trading with you guys, it's freaking addictive.
Isn't it?
Yes. it's time-consuming addictive. So
yeah.
I would rather do this lazy thing because it takes up your time.
Yeah. And
unless you really love it.
Were you going to make a point, Miranda?
No, I was just going to say I do consume financial media. I think about this stuff and I write about this stuff. But as far as my own portfolio and the time and energy I put into my own portfolio, yeah, that's a lot less.
You're right. I think a lot of the stuff I was just saying is really me being a journalist more than it is with my own investments. In fact, as you alluded to too, Aaron, as we've done this podcast, especially with the one we do every 2 weeks where we talk about our investing, you guys will say, like, I bought this. Now, next thing you know, I'm off the podcast looking it up. You know, because so you guys are making me do a little more work than I was doing before because you're bringing up stuff and telling me you're making money. And so I'm looking at it myself. But anyway, the bottom line is there is such a thing as a lazy man's portfolio, also called low maintenance portfolio,
portfolio. Can we say lazy person's portfolio,
okay,
please?
Okay, fine. Lazy person's portfolio. Jeez.
Yeah, that's more 21st century.
Yeah, believe me, even 20th century for that matter. But anyway, okay, so there is a way to do this. You can actually have one investment only if you want to, and you can hold it for your whole life. You can have three investments. You know, I wrote a book called Money Made Simple. I wrote this book in 2005.
Here we go again with the plugs.
Help it, man. I've done very few things of worth in my whole life. Do you mind if I keep bringing them up all the
time?
No,
he has awesome books. Everybody should go and buy them.
I signed your paycheck too, don't I?
Money, okay, so, please.
Anyway, so I wrote that, and here's what I said. You don't need an investment counselor of any kind. You don't need a bunch of complicated investments. All you need is your driver's license. Pull it out. See how old you are and then take that age from 100. So if you're 40 years old, 100 minus, you know, 100 or 40 from 100 is 60. You should have 60% of your money in stocks. The other 40%, 20%, half of that, 20% of your assets, these are long-term savings I'm talking about, should be in an intermediate term bond fund. And the other last 20% should be in some sort of cash equivalent, a money market fund or something of that sort.
No, I've heard that before, but I've also read that they've been adjusting that to be about 110 or 120.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, it's just a matter of how aggressive you want to be. So if you've got 120, then you're going to have more in stocks. The bottom line is you can do something that simple. And the name of the book was Money Made Simple, How to Invest in Minutes a Year. How to Manage Your Money in Minutes a Year, I think is what the subtitle was. So anyway, you can do this. Now, what's weird is that you would think that if you only have a couple of investments and you don't really need any spend much time on them at all, obviously that's going to radically underperform somebody like me who has 30 stocks and spends all kinds of time managing it. But you know, the truth is, it's not true. You could probably get 90% of my returns, maybe better. I mean, you know, because I'm no genius, but you could probably get 90% of a professional's returns with 10% of the effort that they're putting into it. So there's nothing wrong with having this lazy person's portfolio. And would you guys say, I mean, I know you have some stocks now, I know you fool around a little bit with cryptos and stuff, but would you say that the vast majority of your long-term investments are in something really simple, Miranda?
I think I was doing like a breakdown at some point, and I figured about 70% of my investment contributions are in index products. Then I keep about 15% in well, so I guess really totally about 85%, because I have about 15% of, you know, my stuff is kept in index products, mostly ETFs. But those are like in more liquid accounts than my tax advantaged accounts. So I have some liquid accounts, and that's mostly index products as well. So, you know, and then I have about 10% of my assets in like individual dividend stocks and REITs that pay dividends and provide some income. And then, you know, about 5% of my monthly investing goes toward, you know, penny stocks, cryptocurrencies, weird things I'm trying out. So, yeah.
Do you think, do you feel like you can, you make as much money doing something really simple? Like, okay, you know what I actually did with my, I have a SEP plan. I have an IRA, I have a SEP, and I have a 401k. So what years ago, I mean, I'm talking 15 years ago, long time ago, I put half of my money into a S&P 500 index fund. And I put, and the other half, I picked three stocks. And I said, because I, okay, this, I guess I was probably 50. And I said, okay, if I can't outperform with my stock picks, if I can't outperform this S&P 500 index fund, I'm going to put all my money in the index fund and stop trying to pick stocks. And for the first 10 years, I mean, I'll tell you if I can remember the stocks. There's one was Google. One was Goldman Sachs. And one was, oh, it was a mining company. I can't remember exactly which one it is now. And so for the first 8-10 years, it was the S&P 500 index fund was beating me. But then I finally beat it because of Google, because Google's gone just ridiculously high. I think I put 20 grand in it. No, 12 grand, I think I put in it. Now it's worth about 50 grand. So I did outperform the index fund, but just barely. But, you know, but when I, not just barely, but took a long time. I'm actually way outperforming it. But the, but then when I got to the point though where I wasn't, and 10 years had gone by, I was like, I don't care. I'm still going to pick stocks anyway. I'm not going to sell all my stocks and put it into an index fund because I just don't want to. So you can't do it. I mean, the index fund for me outperformed my stuff.
I think that makes a good point. But yeah, no, I personally probably don't make as much money as I could. But for me, it's not about beating the market or making more than the next person. For me, it's like, is my portfolio helping me reach my goals? Is my portfolio enabling me to live the lifestyle I want? If the answer is yes, I'm not somebody who's like, okay, well, I need an extra $15,000 in the bank to make me feel good about myself. And that $15,000 doesn't really change. And I recognize that I'm very privileged to be in this position. But I, you know, after more than a decade of investing, almost 2 decades of investing, so I recognize that I'm very privileged to be in this position. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, could I have captured more gains? Yes. I got a lot of people asking me if I had investing FOMO after Bitcoin hit 60K, because I had sold a portion of my Bitcoin when it was around the 30K range. And then I had sold a little bit more when it hit around the 55K range. And so then when it finally hit 60K, people were like, oh, do you regret not holding on and selling later? And I'm like, no, because I took some profits. I got money in the bank. The extra money wasn't going to change that much about what I'm doing. Now, for some people, that money can make a huge difference. And, you know, and maybe it matters more to them. But for me, I personally am like, well, I'm meeting my goals. I'm able to live the lifestyle I want. Making more money isn't that important because I have a stress-free way to index and be consistent over time.
Okay. Okay. Now, when I'm going to ask you for specific recommendations of funds, or I'm going to offer some. So if you want to have a really, really simple investment portfolio, if you want to spend all your time on the beach and none of your time in front of your computer, I'm going to tell you exactly how to do that right after this super quick break. Don't move a muscle. Okay, we are back. And now I want to help people be able to spend all their time playing shuffleboard and none of their time balancing their portfolio or looking at the stock market at all. So what Give me an example. Actually, let me ask this question. I can think of two ways you can have just one fund that'll do everything. Can you think of what they might be? Putting you on the spot. Either one of you guys.
I mean, some sort of like an all market fund or the S&P 500 fund. I mean, I would just be, I mean, and that's one of the ways I started investing. I mean, there was a point in my life where 100% of my IRA was in an S&P 500 index fund.
See, here's something you forgot about. You know, but you forgot. The balanced fund. There are balanced funds out there.
Ah, yes.
A balanced fund is a fund that invests in both stocks and bonds. So it's only one fund. It's called balanced for an obvious reason, because it's balancing both stocks and bonds. So you can have one balanced fund that theoretically can take care of everything for you. So for example, many balanced funds will have 60% in stocks, 30% in bonds, 10% in cash. Just like I was saying, you know, if you're 40 years old. So you could have just one fund and not have to worry about anything. Here's another one that you know, Miranda, but you didn't think of because I put you on the spot. It's because it's target date funds. Same thing. Yeah. A target date fund, you're telling you what year you're going to retire. And then, it like, for example, it'll say, I'm going to retire. You'll say, I'm going to retire in 20 years. It's a 20-year target date fund. So it automatically increases your bond investing and cash investing and decreases your stock investing within that same fund. So the closer you get to retirement, the less risk you're taking. It's reducing that risky part of your portfolio. So all you got to know then is how long it's going to be before you retire. You're done. One fund. So what do you think? Have you heard of those, Aaron? Balanced and target dates?
I have not heard of those.
So you can do that. Now, target date funds, I'm not a huge proponent of target date funds because they tend to have a higher management fees than balanced funds. And this is also something you really need to pay attention to, folks. If you're going to try to make things really simple for yourself, I encourage you to do that. But also be sure and look at your fees, because they make a lot of difference, especially over long periods of time. So look at the fees. I'm a Vanguard fan because Vanguard traditionally has the lowest cost mutual funds. But there are other funds out there too. I don't work for Vanguard. So, you know, take a look at that and you might be able to do that as well. So you have... No, none of those for you. No target dates for you, Miranda, and no balance funds?
No. I use stock index funds and stock index ETFs, and also bond index funds and bond ETFs.
I have no bond funds at all.
Yeah. And then it's a very small amount. I have a fund that invests in emerging markets. So I have an emerging market bond fund, which has some higher yields. And then I also have, I have one of those inflation protected kind of instruments that includes like a TIPS fund, and includes that kind of stuff.
That's not a bad idea, especially these days.
Yeah. So I have a little bit of that going, and, you know, over the years I've added like REITs. So I have some real estate exposure, real estate
investment
trusts. You
got a lot of funds.
Yeah. I was going to say,
it's not really a lot, right?
It sounds like a lot.
Well, no, it's because it's the asset allocation, right? I've got the S&P 500, right? I've got that S&P 500. I've got, for geographic, I've got like a emerging market fund. And I've got I have a lot. I've collected them. I've got a TIPS, and I've got the REITs, and then I've got an all world stock fund. Oh dear gosh.
Addiction.
Oh yeah. No.
How many do you think you have off the top of your head? 10 more?
I'm going to have to I probably have about 8. But they're in different accounts doing different things, right? Like I've got the retirement account, right, with the asset allocation, and then I've got the travel fund / emergency whatever.
Are you managing all of these, or do you have all of these set up to like auto fund?
Yeah, they're all set up auto fund. They're all set up auto fund with the asset allocation set, so I don't have to think about it. So I chose these things in different accounts with different goals. Once, and then they auto fund.
here's a confession I can make to you guys. It's only since we met, since the three of us started podcasting, that I've had anything international. I've never had, and I've been doing this for 40 years. I may be lying because 40 years is a long time and I can't remember, but I don't think I've ever owned an international stock index fund. And since just this year, I've bought a Europe fund a little bit, and I bought a international fund too, or emerging markets. I'm sorry, emerging markets fund. And so I've managed to be successful in my investing, never investing outside the United States. And when you do, if you start reading about lazy portfolios, for you guys out there listening, you'll find that they'll often suggest, they'll say 500 index, you know, the S&P 500 index fund or total stock market fund. Then they'll say, and also make sure you get 30% in an international stock index fund, and then, you know, 30% in a bond fund or something like that. And it's not bad advice. I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying it's, you know, the United States is the tail that wags wags the world dog, you know? So I just invest in the United States.
But I will say this to add to that. I saw, you know, you ever see those moving charts over time where the graphs move and it shows you different changes in the world stage as it goes through time, like from 2000 to 2021. So I saw this graph where it showed economic power of each country over time. And so you'll see the graph bar move, you'll see the United States growing and growing and growing, but then you'll see China growing and growing and growing until it becomes number two on the world stage. And one curious thing was India was nowhere on this map when you see it start out in 2000, and then it creeps, and all of a sudden it becomes number four. And I was like, that's interesting. Now you can see the next comer coming up. You know, so I could see where international fund would be interesting in that realm, because there's other economies that are growing.
Yeah, well, there's other. You know, I think it's funny, and I'm glad you brought this up, because it also takes us to our next topic, which is how do you rebalance? You know, you are lazy, but you're not lazy where you never touch anything again, because things change over time. And you just brought that up. You know, and I think it's funny when I hear now people will say, or the news will say, you know, China, or politicians will say, you know, their economy is never going to be bigger than ours. We're going to have the world's biggest economy. We always will. We're the United States of America. You know what? They've got 1.3 billion people, guys. We've got 300 million, 350 million. Well, obviously, if their economy gets as developed as ours, and it's certainly heading in that direction, although, you know, not there yet, of course they're going to have a bigger economy than us. And India also has more than a billion people. They've got three times the population. Of course their economy is going to get bigger. So when things like that, when you start seeing things like that happen, that's when you start going back and looking, oh, maybe I should have an emerging markets fund or an Asia fund, you know, or something like that. Because, you know, there's no crime in their economy being bigger than ours. It's fine. But especially if you have access to investing in it, so why not do that, right?
Yeah. So I think part of it is just, for me, it's just been like, well, I have different accounts that accomplish different things in my portfolio, and so, you know, and I want to make sure I'm not overlapping too much while I've got these different accounts, and so I'm like, okay, so I'm going to put funds in this account and funds in this account, but they're going to be accomplishing different things.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's good. And you know, Aaron, you're a theme that you bring up periodically, and I think it's an excellent one, is that the world changes, and your job as an investor is to try to figure out, what was it? Is it Gretzky that said it's not important to know where the puck is; it's important to know where the puck's going. And you know, knowing which economies are growing, and which sectors of our economy are growing, and looking in advance is how you make money. So it's important to be lazy with your portfolio, but think about the way the world's moving. Where is it going to go next? And then every now and then, maybe it's every 10 years, you know, but you've got to take a look and make sure that you're still, like I mentioned last time we talked about investing on our investing podcast, I said I've owned bank stocks in 2009 and oil stocks since 2009. Well, guess what's happened since 2009? Fintech has happened. Guess what else has happened? Alternative energy has happened. And so even though I've owned these things since 2009, I'm out. I'm not out now, but I'm going to get out because the world's changing. And so I'm a very, very slow, I'm a buy and hold guy, but I got to see which way the world's turning. And then I got to take my money out of one thing and put it in another in order to stay ahead of that puck. Make sense?
So a little bit of laziness, a little bit of managing.
Okay. Well said. A little bit of laziness. But now, speaking of which, okay, if we're a lazy investor, we're on the beach, We've got a couple of funds. They're doing all the work for us. We're getting 90% of the return with 10% of the effort, or let's say 2% of the effort. How often do we need to look at those to make sure we're still in the right place, or rebalance them? Because if we're in stocks, like if we're half stocks and half bonds 5 years ago, well, we're going to be 90% stocks now because stocks have gone up so much. So most of our money is, you know, that ratio is going to change. So how often do we have to rebalance those funds? I'd go one. I'd look at it.
Oh, you go one.
Yeah. I mean, I look at mine. I check to see how things are doing, like probably about, well, it depends on the portfolio, right? My retirement portfolio, I look at like once a year, make sure the asset allocation isn't crazy, see if I need to make changes. My more short term, like the travel fund, that thing I look at probably about once a month, and think about that. And then, you know, when I'm doing an experiment like Dogecoin, I freak out and look every day, which is why I don't do a lot of that, because it's like the roller coaster ride is something that I just don't have that emotional risk tolerance for.
Well, you know, I used to say, and with this, I'll conclude and we'll go to our questions, but I used to say that what I told you at the beginning of this podcast, what I wrote in 2005, you take your age from 100. You know, put that percentage into stocks, divide the other, what's left, into bonds and money market, done. Don't do anything else. And actually, in my book, I actually proved that does work just as well as having a managed fund, for example. So anyway, but you know what I say now? I say always take 10% of your long-term savings and put it into stocks, the ones that you pick. And if you have the wherewithal to do that, if you have that kind of attitude, and that risk tolerance, because I've hit some home runs, guys. And, you know, funds are a great way to outperform banks, but you hit singles and doubles. If you want to hit that home run, and you do, you got to take a chance every now and then, buy a stock or two. I've made way more money on Apple than I made on everything else. Look what I just told you about the outperforming the S&P 500 index fund, because I bought Google. You know, so to me, at least, like I said, not for everybody, but to me, it's important to take a portion of that stuff and look around, see what's going up and see why, and then maybe take a chance every now and then. Because I'm up Alphabet. You know how much I'm up on Alphabet? I bought that 2010. I'm up 730%. So it's, to me, I like to swing for the fence every now and then, but keep most of my powder dry. I mean, not dry, but in mutual funds.
And everything we're saying here is under the suggestion that you're going to have an annual growth rate of what, about 10%, 8%?
That's 10% is historical. That's
right. And if you do this lazy man way, you do it over, what, 26 years, you can retire a millionaire?
Yeah, certainly can. That's my intention. So anyway, you got anything else, Miranda, or should we go into our questions? You're reading them today.
Yeah, I say let's go into our questions.
Lay it on me. Who's all right, first?
So our first one is from Tony. Tony says, my mother died in February 2019. She was in a nursing home receiving Social Security and was suffering from dementia when she died and left no assets. A few months later, my brother, who was her caretaker, received a letter from the Social Security Administration informing him that my mother was overpaid a little more than $3,000. My brother called the SSA and informed them that my mother had died. He was sent a form for a waiver of the overpayment, and he completed the form and mailed it to the SSA. Now he's received another letter informing him that the waiver has been denied. Can the SSA go after my brother or any of my mother's children for this overpayment?
Okay, so mom was in a nursing home. She died with nothing. And then the SSA, Social Security, came along and said, we overpaid your mom. We need that money back. That's the question, basically, right?
That's basically it. So can they come after the children's assets?
Okay, generally speaking, let's assume you're alive. If you're overpaid Social Security, they can come after you for that. And it does happen. They do actually accidentally overpay people. Now, if you should die, your estate is liable, or the beneficiaries of the estate are responsible. So remember, when you die, your estate is born. And so you obviously can't pay it back because you're dead. However, your estate, if it has any money, can pay it back, and the Social Security Department expects it. However, the estate or the beneficiary of the estate is responsible only to the extent of the proceeds of the estate. So in other words, if what Tony has said is true, His mother died, has no money whatsoever to pay that back. Her estate has no money whatsoever to pay that back. Then Social Security probably won't collect it. I will add this, though. If she was in a nursing home and her Social Security checks were going to the nursing home, now they may have to pay it back. Here's a quote from Social Security. A representative payee, which could be the nursing home, if they were receiving the money directly from Social Security, a representative payee who receives payments on the beneficiary's behalf after the death of the beneficiary can be liable for repayment of this type of overpayment. So what I would probably do here if I were Tony, if I've got the facts right, I would probably not worry. If she really died with no money whatsoever, you're probably not liable. The nursing home might be, but that's not your problem. So you're probably okay. You might want to call them and talk to them. You might also want to talk to a consumer attorney if things get hairy.
Now, if the estate included a house that was gifted to another child.
No, that's not incest. I mean, that's an asset.
That's okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, they would still have to pay.
So it's weird that he called the Social Security office and they didn't give him the correct information.
Well, yeah. And actually, I don't know if you're being sarcastic, but that happens often. The Social Security Department, I mean, I'm sure they're nice. They are nice people. I've talked to them, but so they do not always give the correct advice. This is complicated stuff. So just because Social Security tells you something, you feel free to double check it. They're often wrong.
Okay, so now I've got one for Aaron, our resident real estate guru. It's from Cecil. Cecil says, what are things to consider when contemplating selling our home and moving into a retirement / senior citizen complex?
Well, there's a lot to consider, actually. You know what's cool? I actually had friends that lived in a 55 and over community. And I thought it was awesome.
I mean, they liked it.
They loved it. Everybody loved
it
there.
Terrible to me.
It sounds terrible, but everybody was playing bingo, you know, on Thursdays, and the pool was awesome, and everything was well taken. We were having barbecues. It made me go, this is where I'd like to go. This is awesome. However, there are pros and cons to everything, right, guys?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's just keep this basic. So you can get into a home. You can get into a townhome. You can get into condos, and there are even 55 and over trailer parks. So I think one of the biggest things you're going to have HOA fees, and there could be assessments in some of these places, which obviously the HOA fees, you can say, okay, this is a set amount, but they could raise every year. So when you're retired, you're going to be on a very stringent cost of living. Those kind of things are you have to watch out for. But on the pro side, I mean, and I don't know if this guy's talking about buying into a 55 and over, or he's considered renting in a 55 and over.
It just says moving, huh? Moving into.
Those are big decisions, and depending on whatever you're doing that or not. Pro of renting is obviously if you're on a fixed income, everything's pretty much set and you know exactly what's coming in and exactly what's going out. Pro is amenities, like I was saying. You know, you can get to play bingo, you have friends, you have the pool, everything's taken care of. When you're there, they can bus you to places. You know, you can bus you to the casino, you can bus you to the grocery store.
I mean,
trust me, there's a lot of casino goers in these 55.
Yeah, that sounds different. That's easy for you guys. I'm 65. I have no desire whatsoever to live in a place like that. But maybe someday I will, but right this minute, I don't want to sound negative at all, because I know a lot of older people do listen to our podcast, but it doesn't sound good to me. I want to be around young people. I want to be around, you know, the right electric atmosphere, you know. Yeah. I want to be around some action.
Right. There is a lack of diversity. You're hanging around all your peers and all that kind of stuff. The pro is that you have more safety and security sometimes. Another con would be there's a lot more rules and regulations. So think about if you're a Thanksgiving person and you want to have everybody around the table during Thanksgiving, there might not be enough parking spaces. They may not have so many guest passes to allow you in. So those are some things to think about. A pro, it might be a little bit more low maintenance than it is to have a house. Houses come with a lot of complications.
You could have houses in these communities too. They don't
you can have houses in communities, yeah. Vast majority of them have, you know, condos and stuff.
Well, one thing's for sure. Let me throw this in here. Always rent, no matter what, first.
I
don't care how old you are or where you're moving to. You always rent first.
I was going to bring that up.
Unless you absolutely can't.
You're absolutely right.
For
definitely
sure.
Rent in them first for a little while to see if you plan on buying in one. I'm actually thinking about buying a bunch of these things because a lot of seniors rent a lot more than they do buy. That's why I was bringing that up.
Can you buy those, Aaron, even though you're under 55?
Yes.
You just can't live there.
No.
Well, I'll tell you, when you're talking about restrictions, I've mentioned several times, because I've always lived in single family houses, and I've probably you guys have probably heard me whine about the issues. I mean, like, I'm so tired of hanging ceiling fans. I'm so tired of everything breaking. I'm so tired of doing everything around the house. And I've said to my friends before, I was like, you know, I'm going to move into a condo, because I live in South Florida. You can't swing a dead cat without hanging a condo. And my friends are like, no, you don't want to do that, Stacey. Because, you know, somebody's going to say you're making too much noise. Somebody's going to not like your dog. Somebody's going to, you know, say that you're somebody's smoking a cigar on your balcony. I mean, you know, there's just a million different things that people will bitch about. And a lot of these people don't have anything else to do but bitch about things.
Right.
So, you know, I'd be wary of that if I were going to move into a place
which
like that.
Which is a great reason why you should rent first before you buy in there. And then,
Absolutely. Of course,
buying and selling, like if you say, oh, it's hard to sell, they're hard to sell. That's regional. I mean, down here in Florida, you can sell them like hotcakes.
Well, you know, I've read this though too, Aaron. When in a retirement community, if they're still developing that, I mean, let's say that you buy a place for $200,000. And they're still developing it. In other words, I'm thinking about a tract of single family houses all in a retirement community, 55 plus. If that developer is still putting up houses and they look identical to yours, and some of them will, and they could decide to sell for $150,000, and you can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
So that if they're identical to yours, your house is no longer worth $200,000. So do you need to look at whether that thing is still under development and how much it's going for and stuff like that. And it's going to cap, because a lot of them are exactly the same. Same thing with a condo.
Yeah.
It's going to cap how much you can sell something for, right?
Yep.
A lot of things to consider. Do some reading.
Yeah, definitely search your favorite search engine, because there's a lot of information out there on those. And there's so many different types of communities like you were talking about. I mean, there's golfing communities where there's a bunch of individual houses that kind of look the same with little golf cart garages and stuff like that. And then you have other ones where they're condo based with, you know, swimming pools and tennis courts.
I remember getting my first letter from AARP when I was 50. I was like 48, whatever I was at the time. And man, I was pissed. I did not want that. And now I'm 65 and I'm pissed about thinking about this. I'm not moving to some 55 plus community. Not me. Can't stand the thought of it. Okay. Anyway, is that the end of that question?
I hope I answered.
Yeah, I think you did.
I hope I answered them.
I'm afraid we're out of time, guys, but we are never out of topic. Dig a little deeper. You're going to find links to lots more info in our show notes. And remember, if your goal is to make more, to spend less, to retire rich, and whose goal is, and who doesn't have that goal? Your online home is moneytalksnews.com. And don't forget to check out Miranda's online home as well. That is Miranda Marquit, MARQUIT.com. If you got a question, a comment, or a topic you'd like to suggest, don't just sit there. Tell us about it. Just email us at hello@moneytalksnews.com. That's hello@moneytalksnews.com. And one last thing, if you appreciate what we do, don't say it. Show us. Subscribe to this podcast. It takes you 2 seconds. Really helps us. So if you like us, show us, please, by subscribing and telling your friends. I'm Stacy Johnson.
And I'm Miranda Marquit.
And I'm Lazy Investing Aaron.
Lazy Aaron. Thanks for hanging out with us, guys. We're going to see you right here next time.